In the coming week, U.S. President-elect Biden begins a turbulent 10-week transition process. Armenians and Azeris react to a Russian-brokered peace agreement, and the 37th ASEAN Summit takes place, hosted virtually from Hanoi. It's November 12, 2020, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, President-elect Biden has secured enough votes to win the Electoral College, exceeding the 270 needed, and that should effectively end the presidential race with incumbent President Trump. However, the incumbent is not accepting those results. We are witnessing at the moment an unusual set of events in which a defeated incumbent will not acknowledge his loss and is thwarting attempts at a normal transition process. This is something that you trace in the newest foreign affairs piece that you've penned with Ivo Dalder. It's titled A Treacherous Transition. So, Jim, could you talk a little bit about what should be happening and what's at stake?
Certainly, Bob. And I think to do that, you really do have to begin with the fact that President Trump has thus far refused to concede the fact that he has lost the election, even though it has been called for his opponent. And he has no realistic chance of seeing the election result overturned either through a recount or by court decision. So in that sense, the transition we're about to go through is very different than what we saw in the 2000 election. You might recall back then, narrow race between Al Gore, George W. Bush. It all came down to Florida. After the initial vote, there was something like 327 votes separating the two, and it went to a recount, court challenges, and the like. Now, traditionally, what happens is that you have the losing candidate concede, even in a close election, even if the race was bitter. Just go back 4 years ago to 2016. Hillary Clinton lost to Donald Trump narrowly, despite winning in the popular vote. And on election night, she phoned Trump and conceded the loss. Now, if current margins hold up and vote counting is done in most states, though not all of them, Biden will end up with 306 Electoral College votes. That's the same as what Donald Trump won in 2016. And while you look at Biden's leads in states like Georgia, 14,000 votes, in Wisconsin, about 20,000 votes, may sound small, they're actually huge when it comes to the issue of recounts. Since the year 2000, only four statewide races have been reversed in a recount, and all of those involve starting differences of just a couple of hundred votes. Now, President Trump and his allies have made a number of allegations that the election should be disputed because of widespread voter fraud. I know that the Texas Lieutenant Governor has now offered a reward of up to $1 million for evidence of voter fraud, but no one has come forward with evidence of widespread voter fraud. It's important to note that the Trump legal team hasn't done so in any of its legal briefings, and we have been witnessing a large number of Republican state election officials defending the validity of the vote that was conducted on their watch. But again, President Trump hasn't conceded the race, and it points out how much of our understanding of the transition really rests on norms. The transition process right now is largely in limbo. President-elect Biden is not receiving the classified briefings a president-elect would normally get to prepare for the job. And under the laws designed to facilitate the formal handover of power, the Biden transition team should be ramping up its planning for assuming office. And earlier this week, you probably heard that the Biden team announced so-called agency review teams that are supposed to meet with senior officials across the federal government to prepare for the new administration's first day on the job. However, that process can't begin until the head of the General Service Agencies provides a green light. Now, the GSA is headed up by a Trump appointee, and so far she has refused to do so or to say when she might do so. So to give one practical example of the consequence of the GSA's refusal to greenlight the transition process, U.S. government health officials like Tony Fauci cannot legally speak with Biden's advisors about the progress on, say, vaccine development, on vaccine distribution, testing capacity, current caseloads, and the like.
And we should add that we're in the midst of a moment in which the U.S. is averaging more than 100,000 new cases a day in what is seen as the worst yet of the pandemic.
Exactly right, Bob. And that case number is rising day by day. We're getting the much predicted second wave. And so, again, if you're the Biden people, you want to basically get in as early as you can to begin getting the lay of the land. Now, in the big scheme of things, sort of the delay in the start of the formal transition is probably more annoyance than a catastrophe. And I think that's one of the reasons why President-elect Biden has been very circumspect and very measured in his comments over the last several days. I think the expectation is that eventually this certification, technical word is ascertainment, will be provided and you'll be able to go forward. Again, going back to 2000, in that case, George W. Bush wasn't declared the victor in the race until December 12th, and we still managed to have a transition. But I think the important message here is that President Trump's continued denunciation of the legitimacy of the election results, as well as some of his personnel moves. Just this week, he sacked essentially the entire senior leadership of the Defense Department. All of that suggests that while we're going to get a peaceful transition to power, we're not going to get a cooperative one.
I want to seize on one thing you mentioned, Jim, which is the norms aspect here, because it just seems like given the stakes here, and despite the assurances that at the end of the day, there will be a transition and so forth, but given the stakes, given the, just the appearance of how this looks to the U.S. counterparts as well as allies, one would imagine or one would think that there would be laws governing this process that at the point when election results are called, that automatically triggers mandated steps as opposed to sort of this normative process in which one side moves forward as expected. Because as with so many other things in the Trump presidency, you know, norms are being upended. And it just seems like it's sending a whole bunch of shivers through the country. And whether it's a smooth dealing with, you know, a COVID-19 response or some other unexpected emergency. And there have been, even in the smoothest transitions, there are things that have occurred in those 70 days that have been troubling.
Certainly, Bob. And this gets back to a broader point about the great challenge you face in trying to draw up legislation that can anticipate all the possible scenarios that can play out. That's why you often end up relying on norms. In this case, I should point out that President Trump is well within his legal rights to insist on a recount. There's nothing in the Constitution or in statutory law that requires President Trump to concede, but we had built up this entire edifice for making the transition go forward on the assumption that people will concede. And that seemed to be a very reasonable assumption to make. I mean, if you go back over the past 100 years, going back to what may have been one of the first concessions, which I think came in the election of William McKinley just before the start of the 20th century, defeated candidates have conceded, often quite gracefully, to their opponent, even if they bitterly disliked the person they lost to. But again, Donald Trump has been a norm buster from the get-go. He's upended the norms and exposed some of the dangers in our system. Now, again, if you look at this transition in the United States, it can last as long as 11 weeks from election day to inauguration day. That's really long compared to other advanced industrialized democracies. In Britain, if you're the incumbent prime minister and you lose, the moving trucks are pulling up to 10 Downing Street the next morning. France is maybe a bit more civilized. They take like 10 days to turn around their system. Again, the United States, 2.5 months, and that's actually shorter than it used to.
Yeah, it used to go until March, right?
That's right. March 4th used to be the time when presidents were inaugurated. That got changed back in the 1930s. But 2.5 months is a very long time. And in some sense, it is both too long for an effective transition in power, because all that takes is someone taking the oath of office. And it's not long enough to staff up the government fully. And again, this is what makes the United States unique compared to its fellow democracies. When a new president comes in, he, and someday she, faces the prospect of having to essentially repopulate the entire upper echelon of the U.S. government. The Biden team, like the Trump team back in 2016, has to fill something on the order of 4,000 positions. About a quarter of those require Senate confirmation. So you got to figure out who the people are. Then you got to get them through the vetting process, which is incredibly burdensome. Indeed, one of the hopes was perhaps this time around, we might be able to get some agreement between the Senate and the White House to sort of streamline that process. Given that it looks like the Republicans are going to retain control of the Senate, I think that's a longer shot. And indeed, the history of American presidential transition is that while the president takes office on January 20th, much of his team doesn't come on board until months afterward. I mean, you're going to be seeing people in a Biden administration, senior positions, confirmable positions, not being confirmed until summertime, or perhaps even later. So this is one of the big challenges you have in the U.S. with the transition is, in essence, you're starting from scratch. And this is why it does help if these agency review teams, what used to be called landing teams, can go in, meet with their counterparts, find out what the state of play is, get up to speed on what's underway so they can make their plans appropriately. But again, I think in this transition, it is going to be a turbulent one, in good part because it doesn't look like President Trump is interested in cooperating. But I think it is also going to be turbulent, because because his administration has been rather haphazard in terms of its organizational operation. It's not clear to what extent a lot of people have already been read into things that the administration is doing. So the Biden team is going to have its hands full.
I would just add that our sister podcast, The President's Inbox, that you host, Jim, has an excellent episode this week with CFR's President Richard Haass, walking through all the aspects of a transition, why this one's so different, what's at stake here. You know, Richard notes that, playing off of a foreign affairs piece of his, that, you know, it's a time where a repair of the world and the world order is desperately needed. But it seems like there's going to be some repair work based on what you just said, Jim, needing to happen just within the institution of the executive branch, perhaps, before some of the bigger work can be done globally.
Most certainly. I think if you look at various agencies, particularly in the intelligence community, particularly in the State Department, they have seen very significant losses over the years. I think a lot of what we call the interagency process has been derailed. And again, administrations, successful governments depend upon having an effective set of operating procedures. And it takes time to build that institutional knowledge up, and it can be squandered quite quickly. One thing the Biden team has going for it is that a lot of the people that I anticipate will be in the Biden administration are veterans of prior administrations. So they actually have a pretty good understanding of how the system is supposed to work. So they have that going for them. And I think that's good news. Bob, let's shift gears. We're going to move away from the United States, and we're going to turn our attention to the Caucasus. And I want to talk about the peace deal that was signed this week by Armenia's prime minister and Azerbaijan's president, and confirmed or overseen by Russia's president. This has to do with Nagorno-Karabakh, the contested region located inside Azerbaijan, but up until recently controlled by ethnic Armenians. To put the size of the disputed territory into perspective, at least for our American listeners, Nagorno-Karabakh is approximately the size of the state of Delaware. So, Bob, what are the initial reactions coming out of Yerevan, the capital of Armenia, and out of Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan, now that we have what looks to be a peace agreement?
Well, it couldn't be more different. Armenia is dealing with a great deal of outrage. People are upset. They're calling it a capitulation. And in Azerbaijan, there's a great deal of, if not euphoria, then just happiness that the country has been able to wrest from Armenian forces territory that it lost a good quarter of a century ago. Azerbaijan's excitement's a little bit tempered by the fact that Russian peacekeepers, up to 4,000 of them, are being deployed as we speak in certain areas that were agreed on, including a corridor that connects Nagorno-Karabakh to Armenia proper. It's basically the ethnic Armenian forces were licked. Azerbaijan has been building up its military, helped by a boost from Turkish military aid, especially drones. They were able to turn this conflict that has been festering and surfacing for a while, but essentially has been dormant for a good two decades. They were able to just sort of mount an effective campaign. And in the course of, I don't know, I think it was 6 weeks or so, they had turned the tables to such an extent that Armenia agreed to the Russian brokered deal that allows Nagorno-Karabakh itself to retain control of its borders, which are not recognized by any countries outside of Armenia. And Azerbaijan gets back seven districts from which its population had been expelled, again, a good 25 years ago. We're talking about almost a million people were displaced within Azerbaijan, a number of them living in railroad cars. And it was a great trauma for the country. I recall writing about it quite a bit when I worked for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. It's a festering issue for Azerbaijan in particular. Armenians were content with the status quo. They wanted to sort of nudge Nagorno-Karabakh into a more of an independent status, which wasn't happening. But there was basically a kind of a dormant process that was petering along, but the Azerbaijanis were working steadily to try to change the facts on the ground, which they appear to have done in this instance, Jim. It doesn't change some of the longer-term issues still. Nagorno-Karabakh is this enclave that's wholly surrounded by Azerbaijan, and its status still remains unclear, but it does retain its own control of those borders while the two sides are supposed to be continuing to talk through other issues. Right now, passions are really hot. It's not expected there to be a surge back into conflict as there had been under previous ceasefires in this recent surge. However, I wouldn't also rule out that this could burble up again as well.
So, Bob, what do you think the long-term consequences are going to be of having 5,000 Russian peacekeepers? I don't know whether that should be in air quotes or not, in Nagorno-Karabakh.
Long-term is the right word, Jim. Under the deal, I believe it was supposed to be a deployment that lasts 5 years, and then the parties would review and decide whether or not it needed to be continued or not. The track record for Russia having peacekeepers anywhere is that they're there for a good long time. You can look at some of the other so-called frozen conflicts in which that has been the case, whether it's Moldova's separatist region of Transnistria, or even more notably, the two breakaway regions from Georgia, South Ossetia and Abkhazia, where they are de facto Russian statelets. Some would say it's about 20% of Georgian territory, or what had been Georgian territory. So I think there is concern that in this case, there's not a Russian occupation of a certain amount of territory per se, but certainly a Russian presence, one of which is this corridor. It's called the Lachin Corridor that connects Karabakh with Armenia. And it's going to be interesting to see to what extent Russia, that offers Russia leverage or not. Some observers have noted that Russia didn't necessarily come out of the deal in this sort of commanding position. Turkey actually seems to have asserted itself through its support of the winning side, Azerbaijan, and its support, again, through providing drones and other assistance, that sort of Turkey's in the region to play in a way that maybe it hadn't been before. I should also note there was unconfirmed reports that Turkey had facilitated the transfer of mercenaries from northern Syria to help in the Azerbaijani side. I haven't seen any confirmation of that. But still in all, Turkey is now very active. They're talking about this era of great power politics playing out again in the region that was known in the past for the so-called great game of great power competition, this sort of Central Asia Caucasus sweep. For Turkey also, there is a energy corridor that's supposed to run through part of the region connecting Azerbaijan to Turkey. So that's also considered a win for the Turkish side. So lots of different elements at play, Jim. It's going to be very interesting to watch. I should also note that traditionally, the United States and France were part of a peace process that was meeting regularly to try to forge ahead with some sort of permanent plan to find a peace between Azerbaijan and Armenia. It didn't really go anywhere. France and the United States were not involved at all in this latest turn of events. Mike Pompeo is going to be making a trip to parts of the region, not Armenia or Azerbaijan, but he's going to be going to Georgia in the next couple of days. He's going to also go to France and Turkey and then several other countries. So presumably this will be coming up in those discussions. It'll be very interesting to see whether the U.S. is going to try to assert itself to a bigger role or how it's going to weigh in or not.
Just getting back to the issue of Turkey and I guess what has been termed a neo-Ottoman foreign policy, how do you see that playing out in the rest of the Caucasus? And I ask that, Bob, in part because Azerbaijan stands out in respect to the fact that it's fairly wealthy. I mean, it's an oil-producing country, so it can afford the weapons. It bought these drones from Turkey, but I believe also Israel, if I understand correctly.
Yes, that's right.
So is Turkey's success here in Nagorno-Karabakh and in siding with Azerbaijan something that's going to really ripple through the region? Or is it really sort of narrowly constrained to this case because of the peculiarities of the way forces lined up?
That is going to be very interesting to watch. And I would add Central Asia to that equation, Jim, as well as the Caucasus, because a number of those countries have Turkish bonds and the commonality of Muslim faith for a majority of the population and so forth. And Russia also, by the way, has great interest in many of the Central Asian former Soviet states. But as it pertains to the Caucasus, you know, Turkey has a border and a sort of a shared space with Georgia and could be looked on in a new way by Georgia as Georgia kind of weighs its options in the region. Georgia continues to be very much at odds with Russia. Georgia is sort of alone as a democracy trying to assert itself. It just came through, by the way, its own kind of turbulent elections with a large opposition crying foul. So we'll have to see how that plays out. But there's
okay, here's where I have to jump in and say, right now we're talking about Georgia, the country.
Georgia, the country,
Georgia,
yes.
The state.
Right.
We just talked earlier
very
on
very important
about
to make that
in the
distinction.
State of Georgia.
Yes, Georgia, the country. And then Armenia itself, you know, Armenia had already been kind of under the sway of Russia. It's had more common bonds through the years with Russia than Azerbaijan had, including an ancient, Orthodox Christian faith. And Russian bases were already in Armenia as well. Armenia had been trying to maintain a kind of a balance where it was opening up to European institutions while still maintaining this kind of Russian tie. And it was in a very kind of tricky situation. Also, Armenia's prime minister who signed the deal is under a great deal of fire right now, Nikol Pashinyan. He himself emerged from a kind of a people power protest movement in the last year or so in Armenia. So his position is seen as a little bit fraught as well. So will Armenia also look to Turkey, which it's had its own very troubled relationship with, especially in the last century or so. Remains to be seen. Armenia is much poorer than Azerbaijan, doesn't have the resource riches that Azerbaijan has. And, will it in some ways find some sort of way forward with Turkey or a way to acknowledge Turkey's presence or seek to further tighten ties with Russia to balance out against Turkey? You know, on top of everything else, there are other pockets in this region that are going to get new attention. attention now. There's an enclave that's part of Azerbaijan that's surrounded by Armenia called Nakhichevan. There's supposed to be more opening to that enclave from Azerbaijan as a result of all of this. So that's going to be something to watch as well, Jim. Some of this is also part of the carving up and some of the moving around of pieces that occurred under Stalinist Soviet Union. And it's sort of still playing out. Jim, I'm going to move us further east over to Southeast Asia. Vietnam's Ministry of Foreign Affairs has just kicked off the 37th summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, also known as ASEAN. And that's going to be taking place over a four-day period that started actually as we're taping this podcast. Prime Minister of Vietnam is set to chair the meetings throughout the four-day summit. But what else should we know about this meeting, Jim, and the virtual aspect, if that's going to have any sway over it?
Well, let's begin with the theme of the conference, Bob, which is cohesive and responsive. And I take it that that is meant to support ASEAN's five priorities for the year 2020, which are peace, prosperity, raising awareness of the ASEAN community, strengthening partnerships, and embracing ASEAN's operational efficiency. What I think much of the conversation ASEAN is going to be taken up with, actually, though, is COVID prevention and control. Probably also a little bit about regional and international issues. In terms of looking at COVID prevention and control, there's a great disparity among the 10 members of ASEAN in terms of their experience with the pandemic. I'll note that some countries, Cambodia, Vietnam, Laos, report very small numbers of cases in the hundreds. Whereas you have a country like Indonesia, admittedly much more populous country, which has something on the order of 500,000 cases. Philippines, something on the order of 400,000 cases. And obviously, as we're discovering here at home, dealing with the pandemic is not just a matter or what you've done over the last several weeks or months, but also what could happen going forward. And again, this ties into the economy because of its ability to disrupt. And here the challenge many of these economies face is that they're smaller and they're plugged into a global economy in which what happens in a place like the United States or in China or in Europe can have ramifications or reverberations for their own situation. Now, the other thing to keep in mind about ASEAN, it's like one of the most fascinating international organizations, is that when it has a summit, it has a lot of other meetings as well. And my understanding is that this year's summit for ASEAN will have at least 20 related meetings. These include the ASEAN Plus 3 Summit, the East Asia Summit, the ASEAN Women's Leaders Summit, the ASEAN US Summit, and the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership Summit, otherwise known as...
That's a lot of Zoom meetings, Jim.
Yeah, that's a lot of Zoom meetings. I think that ASEAN is trying to give the EU a run for its money in terms of how many meetings they can hold. Now, I'm not going to run through all 20 meetings. Let me just flag a couple. One is RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. And what it is going to do is sign a trade agreement involving 15 countries in the Indo-Pacific region. Think of ASEAN plus Australia, China, Japan, New Zealand, and South Korea. India had been part of the negotiations, but dropped out because it thought the deal was going to hurt its own domestic economic interests. Now, assuming the signing goes forward, RCEP will become the world's biggest free trade agreement by population. It'll cover about 30% of the world's population in GDP. And what it means is big tariff cuts for the ASEAN and Pacific Rim signatories. What will also happen is that RCEP will establish common rules for things like e-commerce, digital trade, intellectual property. As big as this sounds, it's not as big a deal as the CTPPP, that's the successor to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, either in terms of the range of economies it includes or the depth of integration that it promotes, but it's nonetheless a big deal.
Yeah, and it's kind of rare to hear about any trade deal at all these days, Jim, so that's also notable.
Well, they have been working on it for quite some time, so this has been a long time in coming. As I noted, India bailed out before it came to fruition. You also have the ASEAN Plus 3 Summit that was created back in 1997 to be an opportunity for ASEAN members to get together with diplomats from China, Japan, and Korea. And then you have the East Asia Summit, which is take ASEAN Plus 3, and then throw in Australia, India, New Zealand, Russia, and the United States. The East Asia Summit bills itself as the only leader-led forum at which all the key partners meet to discuss political, security, and economic challenges facing the Indo-Pacific. Now, what we would typically do in a pre-COVID world is we'd be talking about what delegations are going to these meetings. Who are the Chinese sending? Who are the Russians sending? Who are the Japanese sending? Who are the Americans sending? So if you recall, President Trump didn't attend in 2000. 2018, didn't attend last year either. And last year's delegation was led by National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien and Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross. These two representatives were the lowest ranking U.S. officials to attend an East Asian summit since the United States began participating. And of course, when you know who's going, you can get into all kind of summitology, trying to figure out what deals are being cut and who's talking to who in the bilateral meetings. But when everything goes virtual, it's not really clear who's speaking or listening for any of the countries. In our case, we spent a lot of time thinking about U.S. diplomats, and we're not really sure who is going to participate. So it's really hard to handicap what's going to come out of this meeting. Having said that, I will note that, one, the Trump administration is transitioning out, so it is not going to be able to do a lot that can have staying power beyond January 20th. Keep in mind that, yes, the Trump administration, the president can issue executive orders, but executive orders signed by one president can be undone by the next president, as President Trump did to President Obama when President Trump came to office. The other thing, I suspect there will be a fair amount of conversation, probably has been a fair amount of conversation, on the margins among a number of these countries as to what the change from Donald Trump to Joe Biden will mean for U.S. policy and conditions in the region. And I will note that there are a number of allies who are happy to see Joe Biden succeed Donald Trump, but I suspect there are a number of others that look at the change and are worried that a Biden presidency won't be as tough on China as a Trump presidency has been. Now, whether that's an accurate assessment or not, I do think that is a perspective. You may even find in some countries hold both views, which is that they're happy to see President-elect Biden become president-elect and eventually president, but equally worried that his administration either won't stand up to China or will be too consumed with domestic politics or domestic issues to provide the kind of presence in Asia, particularly in East Asia, that many of them want. So, Bob, we made it to the figure of the week portion of our podcast. Who or what is your figure of the week?
Jim, my figure is a person, and it is the just impeached president of Peru, Martin Vizcarra. Earlier this week, he was impeached under charges of corruption, taking bribes that related to a period when he was a regional governor, as well as mismanagement of the country's coronavirus pandemic. And on that front, I would just add, Peru is suffering one of the highest levels of death in its population from coronavirus infections. I think it's the second highest number of deaths after Belgium as a proportion of population. So it's something like 35,000 dead. It's got about 1 million confirmed cases. It's really been devastated by the coronavirus. So it's that, but it's also, this also gets to, I think, some bigger problems in Peru, which is political instability. I mean, it has a unicameral legislature, so one main house has a relatively easy path to impeach a president if it falls out of favor for whatever reason. And the president himself had dissolved parliament just a year ago, I think. And so there are forces in the parliament, including what looks to be increasingly populist forces that had run afoul of the president. There have been these percolating charges of corruption, and corruption had, by the way, been the cause of the downfall of the previous president, Pedro Pablo Kuczynski. And I should note, there's another former president, Alan Garcia, who committed suicide last year while being subjected to a corruption probe. So Peru is dealing with tumultuous politics, on top of which, again, getting hit hard by the coronavirus, its economy is in rough shape. And Mr. Vizcarra has decided to exit the scene without pushing back that much at all. And his successor is the head of Peru's Congress, Manuel Merino. He was sworn in this week, and he has vowed that there will be elections in April, presidential elections, and he would stand, meanwhile, as a leader until next summer.
Is he pledging not to run himself, or is he going to stand as a candidate for president?
Jim, as best I can see from reports, he has not said whether he would run. The reports I've seen just say he will serve until the end of July 2021. So we'll have to wait and see. It's a wild and woolly world of politics in Peru. And I think partly we'll also have to see the state of the country. Merino appeared at his swearing-in, very demonstrably wearing a mask and vowing to get the coronavirus response under control and bring down the devastating numbers in the country. If Peru ends up emerging on the other side of this by its April elections in a much better shape, that could be indicative of his popularity or maybe some allies. Again, he comes from a party with a sort of a populist bent, and that could be a ticket for that party or him continuing on in a leadership role. Again, this country has gone through a number of leadership changes. Its economy has been reeling for a number of years as commodity prices have collapsed. It's one of the world's largest producers of copper. We'll have to see how it comes through this latest turn of events. It's incredibly shaky time, and it's causing a whole bunch of concern. I should should also note that in terms of popularity, Mr. Viscara actually polled very highly in public popularity, even as he ran afoul of the legislature.
I'll note, Bob, as you were describing what's happening in Peru, I was struck that we're seeing echoes of it in other parts of Latin America. Political instability, charges of corruption, decaying state infrastructures, and concerns about the ability to respond. So are we witnessing sort of a broader trend here in Latin America? Because again, I think of Argentina, I think of Brazil, I think of Chile, I think of Colombia, where we've seen sort of an upswing in problems after about a decade or so where people were sort of thinking about, gee whiz, Latin America was calm and placid compared to the upheavals we're seeing in the rest of the world.
I think it's a very safe bet that we're looking at another period. And it's those countries you mentioned all come at it from very different sort of perspectives and different contexts, Jim. And I would throw into that mix in Bolivia, which just had elections.
Fair
elected
point.
An official who's aligned with socialists, who's seen as more technocratic, but still has his job cut out for him. Venezuela, as we've discussed many times before, really difficult spot. They are reeling under COVID and the return of many Venezuelan nationals who had fled the country under political mismanagement and really close to a failed state situation there. You know, Colombia dealing with a lot of unrest. Colombia was a real poster child for success in South America. Chileans have just voted for a constitutional reform, but they're going to go through a fraught period as well. It's a really difficult time. Brazil, people are watching very closely to see how Brazilians respond. They were also watching closely after the U.S. election results came in, how Jair Bolsonaro was reacting. And, you know, he still retains some popularity, but Brazil goes through its own kind of manic political cycles as well. And I think we should be watching that very closely too.
Will do, Bob.
Jim, how about you? Who or what is your figure of the week?
Bob, my figure of the week is a number. It's the number 12. The International Atomic Energy Agency reported this week that Iran now holds roughly 12 times the amount of low-enriched uranium permitted to it under the terms of the 2015 nuclear deal. Now, low-enriched uranium can, of course, be processed into highly enriched or weapons-grade uranium. To clarify for people, low-enriched uranium is uranium that is up to 4.5% pure, whereas weapons-grade or highly enriched uranium, HEU, is 90% or more. As best we can tell, given the amount of LEU that Iran has, it could, if it processed it, refined it, produce enough HEU for two nuclear weapons. I'm going to leave it to international lawyers as to whether Iran is actually in violation of the 2015 nuclear deal. Of course, Donald Trump famously quit the deal back in May of 2018 and then reimposed stiff sanctions on Tehran as part of his administration's maximum pressure strategy. And since last summer, Tehran has slowly moved away from some of the agreement's restrictions. Among other things, Iran has installed more sophisticated centrifuges to generate HEU. But as best we can tell, according to the IAEA report, Iran has not yet fed uranium into those centrifuges. I'll point out that so far, Donald Trump's maximum pressure strategy has hurt the Iranian economy, perhaps even crippled it. But that punishment, that pain, has not changed Iranian behavior. No doubt Democrats are going to argue that Iran's nuclear capabilities actually grew on Donald Trump's watch. In fact, the problem may be even worse than we know. There is still no adequate explanation for a facility that the Israelis revealed last year that may have been part of a nuclear weapons program that the Iranians pursued. There are traces of uranium found at that site, and the IAEA report said that Iran's explanation for that finding simply weren't believable, sort of failed on technical grounds. Of course, if you're President-elect Biden, you're going to inherit this situation. Biden has said during the campaign that he would like to get the United States back into the 2015 deal, provided that Iran returns to full compliance and agrees to new negotiations to extend and broaden the deal. Iran has said it is open to resuming negotiation, but it wants a lot in return. Among other things, it wants compensation for the economic pain it has had to deal with because of Trump's maximum pressure sanctions. So it's unclear whether we're actually going to get new negotiations. And obviously, the Biden administration is going to figure out how it's going to deal with Iran. And it's going to do that given that the Iranians have indicated they're going to pay a very heavy price in order to at least preserve the option to have a nuclear weapons program.
Yeah, this IAEA report really kind of tees up issues for the two main positions in the U.S., at least on the Iran deal, which is one side hardliners saying, aha, see what we mean? Iran is hell-bent on developing weapons-grade capacity. We have to ramp up even further this maximum pressure campaign. They're starting to break in other areas, and this is something we have to keep on doing until they relent. Whereas people who were in support of the Iran nuclear deal would say, au contraire, things were going just fine when there was, first of all, a greater level of scrutiny and engagement that was creating some confidence in Iran that it didn't need to develop its nuclear program. And instead, things have ramped up under the Trump administration. Great deal of food for debate. Feelings are really hard on both sides. And, you know, yet another massive challenge for the Biden administration, Jim.
Well, Bob, I'm going to climb out on a limb and say that while we may get some bipartisanship on issues like China and Russia during a Biden presidency, I don't think you're going to witness bipartisanship when it comes to Iran policy.
That's a safe limb to climb on, Jim. And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. India celebrates the festival of Diwali. Moldova holds a presidential election runoff. And the annual Leonid meteor shower peaks.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you can get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not as CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Special thanks to Anna Shortridge, Cara Jackson, and Kendall Ross for their assistance. This week, our recording engineer was Zoe Collins. Thank you, Zoe. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and be careful out there.